streets. Years earlier, he sued the U.S. government to stop the Vietnam War, arguing the president had violated constitutional limits on his power. And in a 40-year career, he also took on the Philadelphia Police Department on issues of brutality and illegal searches, the CIA, in the case of a former analyst who died after being given LSD, and perhaps most famously, the FBI, in the case of the Camden 28, which led to a courtroom drama trial that Supreme Court Justice William Brennan called one of the great trials of the 20th century. David Carey has written a book about his experiences. It's called Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. He is now a professor at the Temple School of Law, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio for the full hour. David Carey, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Dave.
Welcome back. You've been here a few times over the years to talk about some of these things, haven't you?
I have. There's some chapters have appeared on this show.
And I wouldn't be surprised if some folks from your past experiences give us a call. The number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we'll be getting some of those calls a little bit later on in the show. But I thought we'd begin this story, David Carey's, in the middle, because it's an amazing case. And this involves Frank Olson, a biochemist who worked for the CIA, who fell 10 stories from a New York hotel room in 1953. And you open the story in the book by describing a party at your house in
yes.
Powhatan where you get this odd phone call. Tell us about it.
Well, I lived in what we called in those days a collective house. And so there were six bedrooms on the second and third floors, and the first floor was common. Everybody used the first floor. And there was a bit of a party going on, kind of informally. And there was the smell of pot in the house, not mine, of course. And the phone rings, and this fellow starts saying, "I'm counsel for," and I could hardly hear it. And so I asked him, "Would he hold?" You know, he sounded like a serious fellow. I went upstairs where it was quiet and picked up the other extension. And he said, "I'm Rod Hill's counsel to the president." And my first reaction was, "President of the United States?" You know, I had no idea who this guy was.
Here you are in your T-shirt and your what?
Yeah, right. Exactly. And I wondered, as I said in the book, if it was a joke because I had done this case involving the CIA and the news was all over. I could picture a friend of mine getting somebody to make this call as a joke, but it wasn't a joke. And he called to, it was on a Friday, to invite Mrs. Olson, the widow, to a meeting with the president, at which the president was going to apologize for the CIA unwittingly dosing his Frank Olson's after-dinner drink with LSD.
The president was Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford.
And so now we've sort of started without really explaining what the case is about.
Yeah.
Frank Olson was this analyst in the CIA, died in 1953 from a fell or was pushed, we don't know.
From a 10th floor in the Sheraton Hotel in New York City. He was a scientist who worked on the highest chemical and biological warfare research at Fort Detrick in Maryland, in this really rural, rolling hills, beautiful area. Right in the middle of there were kind of unmarked buildings that are the center for our biological and chemical warfare. And they were at a retreat, a yearly event in Western Maryland. And one of the high CIA officials, they all worked CIA, Army, military, intelligence, various agencies, spiked the after-dinner liqueur with LSD, a rather large portion of LSD. Now, this is before, you know, Timothy Leary and before the Beatles sang Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and before it was popularly known.
Eisenhower was president. It was a different country then.
Totally.
And so this
different.
Was experimentation. They were experimenting with it for, as what, a truth serum or just to see what its effect? Well, we don't know.
Well, we don't know why they gave it to him. We know they were using it as a truth serum. There was some talk of using it more broadly. They used it with interviews. Like sometimes people would come in for an interview to be a CIA agent or another kind of agent, and there were uses like that, thinking that it would be like a truth serum. So he has no experience with what this is. So I mean, it would be terrifying. And you know, it was a terrible trip, hallucinations. You have no sense that it ever will be over. And instead of sending him to a doctor for treatment, they sent him to New York to see an allergist. Now, the allergist was chosen not because that has anything to do with the problem or could help Frank Olson, but he was one of the leaders of the CIA's chemical research and knew a lot about LSD.
So he ends up in a hotel room and going out of the window and falling to his death. And his wife and children for years had no idea that LSD was involved at all. And at some point,
no.
As revelations in the early 70s about the CIA's misdeeds emerge, they become aware and you become involved in the case. I guess because you knew Frank Olson's son, is that why?
My partner, David Radofsky, who was my partner in the civil rights law firm through a lot of this book, had known Eric. And Eric called and then engaged us, the family engaged us to do the case.
All right, so that brings us to a point. You have a suit against the government for this terrible act of unknowingly giving this guy LSD, which leads to his death. And then you get this call. The president wants to apologize, not to settle the case, right?
Right.
They want no lawyers involved. Now, how do you respond?
Well, I was conscious of saying I have to get into lawyer mode and out of party mode.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thought that came to me is, of course, Alice will love this. Alice was the widow, and the children will think this is appropriate, and they deserve it. But it felt premature. Usually the sides get together, pat each other on the back, and say whatever mea culpas there are. There usually aren't many in settlements. After the case is settled. And I was worried. The media was on this. They had a news conference. It had struck a media court. Everywhere we went on this case, we were followed. We had been to the CIA. We had been all over. Or we went to the CIA. And we went to the Attorney General, and the network TV cameras were right behind us. So I was worried that it would be perceived as over. And I also right away thought, well, we better start defining the way the media plays the case. And so I called Alice, and she was very moved by it. And I asked her, you know, is it all right with you if I negotiate some terms before we just accept this? They sound very eager. They want it to happen on Monday. It's a news cycle thing. And she said, yes, but make sure I get this apology. You know, she wanted the apology. And
she wanted the president to
apologize.
Own up to what had happened to her husband.
Yeah, and it meant a lot to her. Anyone can understand why. So I made a series of demands. No TV, only a picture, a very, you know, discreet, low-key picture about the meeting, released still picture. And that there would be a joint statement where we could edit what they say, but they couldn't edit what the family said. And they agreed.
So your concern here was that you didn't want the media to think that the president spoken to Mrs. Olson, this whole thing is over.
That it's over.
And you also wanted leverage. And at that point, you didn't have all the information from government files that you needed. And you got a commitment.
Yeah,
in return for this meeting to get those
files. As part of this, I wanted a commitment that we would be treated at the top levels of the Justice Department, and we would receive every single government document that had anything to do with this. And so appointments were made to see the director of the CIA, William Colby, and to see Edward Levy, the Attorney General of the United States, and the statements were done as we said.
We're speaking with David Carries, a well-known Philadelphia civil rights attorney who's written a new memoir called Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer, and we're talking about a remarkable case involving Frank Olson, a CIA analyst who was killed after falling from a New York hotel room, and David is recounting part of the lawsuit filed by his family. We could, of course, spend the hour on this, and we won't, but one of the things that I find interesting about it was that the information that you got from the government left a lot of questions unanswered, didn't it?
Yes. They first gave us a wad of papers, maybe an inch and a half thick. And they said, this is everything. Well, you know, we take it back to Philadelphia and start reading it. And it doesn't explain, you know, why they give them LSD. If it's an experiment, there should be something about what they're trying, what knowledge they're hoping to gain, what follow-through there was. Nothing. There was just no explanation. And then the story of what happened the actual night in the hotel room did not seem credible. I consulted experts about suicide. They claimed it was suicide. They then turned around and gave Mrs. Olson benefits that aren't allowed if it was really a suicide in order to keep her from suing.
And they say he simply woke up and leaped through a window?
A running dive through a window that was closed and the blinds were drawn. So people who usually commit suicide open the blinds, open the window, and jump out. Very unusual and a quite unusually accurate dive to just get yourself right through all of that and get out there. And so the question right away was, there was no good explanation for what had happened. So did he really jump? And if he didn't, did somebody help him facilitate a suicide or kill him?
And for technical and legal reasons, the family did get a settlement actually through an act of Congress rather than a court settlement. But I'm wondering what the alternative explanations might have been for his death and to what extent the family wanted to pursue them.
Well, the family was divided. And the oldest son, Eric, I think it's fair to say just never accepted the government's explanation. I really didn't accept the government's explanation. I didn't know what happened, but I didn't think what they said explained what happened in the slightest. Alice wanted to settle, and she had just been through so much, raising three children
alone
with the false knowledge that your husband and their father has inexplicably killed himself. Horrible thing.
You didn't really see a motive for murder exactly here.
I didn't. And that was what was missing from the possible murder conclusion, because you'd think they'd have to cover up something big. Now, it looked like he might have turned into a whistleblower. That was a possibility. But it still didn't look like they needed to kill him. You know, as you said, you're back in the 50s. Nobody disbelieved the government in those days. So it didn't make sense. Now, since then, Eric's continued the struggle, and his brother Nils as well. And they've had an autopsy done, et cetera. And there is some possibilities of motive.
David Carey, a veteran civil rights lawyer, has a new memoir. We'll be back to talk about it in just a moment.
Next time on Symphony Cast. If the light could shine for him, it could shine for anyone. Sergei Prokofiev's Soviet homeland was in the darkest misery of World War II, and his new symphony predicted victory. Hi, I'm Brian Newhouse. Don't miss Prokofiev's Fifth in a great performance from the Philadelphia Orchestra on SymphonyCast from American Public Media.
Sunday night at 10 o'clock on WHYY.
Greg, it seems like you can't turn on a radio or television without hearing about High School Musical or the Jonas Brothers.
You're right, Jim. Since the beginning of rock and roll, it's been the teens who are calling the shots.
Yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy and I feel like I'm loving you.
I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. And this week on Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to explore the musical genre that has had teens screaming for half a century, bubblegum pop.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, two looks at the current state of medicine. We talk with Dr. William Hansen about an electronic nose that identifies disease, destroying tumors with a proton beam, and other high-tech developments in medicine. And Dr. Jim Withers tells us about treating the homeless on the streets of Pittsburgh. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moscow. And our guest today, veteran Philadelphia civil rights lawyer David Carey. He's taken on the CIA, the FBI, the White House, and the Philadelphia Police again and again, and has some fascinating stories recounted in a new book called Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. If you want to talk to Dave Carries and recall some of these cases or ask questions, we'll be getting to some calls a little later. The number 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, you know, David Carries, you came here in 1968, is that right?
Yes.
Almost right out of law school from Baltimore.
Yeah. Well, the law school was from New York, but grew up in Baltimore.
Right. And you walked into the public defender's office. Give us just a little bit of a picture of kind of what that was like, what kind of city this was.
Well, it was very, very confusing and rather intimidating. Got this job and reported for work the day after Labor Day, 1968, and I didn't know Philadelphia, and it was at 13th and Market, and I get off the elevator up on the 8th floor, and it's just a hustle-bustle full of clients in a big reception area, and then there's lawyer's office, there's what looks like secretaries, and bigger offices in the back that are probably the management. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm looking at it all and thinking, everybody knows what to do but me. Because
right.
I don't have a clue. And then they take me into a room, give me the tools of the lawyer trade, which is a very large yellow pad,
right,
and some yellow pencils. And my first thought was, I can't think of anything I could write a whole yellow page about, you know? I mean, I don't know that much. When you get out of law school, it's the same today. You're not really ready to be a lawyer. So,
let me take you one to an early case here. I mean, and this was 1968. This was a Philadelphia in which, you know, you've got roiling international stuff going, and it was 1968. It was the Tet Offensive. It was Martin Luther King's death. It was Bobby Kennedy's assassination. Frank Rizzo was police commissioner. Jim Tate was the mayor.
I had come from Columbia Law School, where the students that year, the year I graduated, took over the whole university.
Right. So, but the case I wanted to focus in on wasn't yours. You're listening to somebody else interview a middle-aged black woman named Mary Giles, who, tears rolling down her cheeks. And you hear the other lawyer, a more veteran guy, someone who presumably knew the ropes, telling her, "I'm sorry, there's really nothing we can do." What was it? What was that?
Well, I'm supposed to be interviewing my own clients, right? There's a stream of clients coming in, but this woman was just had this gravelly, resonant voice, and she was crying and waving her arms, and so I started listening, and what she said was her husband had been picked up by the police after a loud argument the night before. They took him into the station, fingerprinted him, and his prints matched up with a man who escaped from a Georgia chain gang 25 years earlier.
In the 40s.
In the 40s. Convicted of murder. And I just started thinking, well, gee, that's about when I'm born, you know?
Uh-huh.
This happened when I'm born. And he comes to Philadelphia. He meets Mary, who's in the office. They have four children. He does construction work, actually did quite well. She knew not a clue about it. Of course, he never told anybody. And she's there to say, "Can you help us?" Well, the lawyer, a guy named Stu, who I was sharing an office with, he says, "Look, there's really nothing you can do. All they have to prove is that the crime was committed, and then the identity of who did it. They have the fingerprint. They even have a conviction. It's not even just a charge. And whatever problems there would be, you'd have to challenge back in Georgia if there was a problem with the trial." And, you know, she's, Lord help me, you know.
Her life shattered.
She's just like moaning. He tells her that, look, the best thing to do is for him to go back. There's nothing you can do. And at least if you go back, he'll get credit for his time. He serves down there. If he stays up in Philadelphia, he won't get any credit for that time. So I have this strong urge, and throughout the book I get many of them. And I want to intervene, but I have absolutely no idea what, if anything, I could do. And here's this really experienced guy who said, there's nothing. And what he said made total sense, you know.
Right.
So
here you are sticking your schnoz into something that you don't know anything about. And,
absolutely.
And a critical question I think listeners are wondering is, well, you know, a murder charge is a pretty serious thing. This guy walked away from a prison chain gang. He, in effect, escaped from prison.
Right.
What were the circumstances that would make one think maybe he shouldn't go back?
Well, I didn't know any circumstances then, so I can't claim to have knowingly stuck my head in. So I just, it was 25 years, I was thinking, whatever he did, obviously he's rehabilitated, or whatever term you want to put on it. He's lived here 25 years, raised a family, had a good job, no trouble. So I was thinking, it's worth whatever could be done, but I didn't know what. It turns out that there was a fight between he and another black man, and the other black man was armed, and it probably was self-defense, the way it turns out. He didn't have a lawyer. It was an all-white jury. The trial was a sham, happened in a couple hours. And he would have been executed if he'd have killed a white man down there. If in that time, if a black man killed a black man, they usually just put him on the chain.
He was 19. It was a personal argument that got out of control.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. But I didn't know that then. I knew that once I went to talk to him. So I asked Stu, the office mate, as tactfully as I could, but it wasn't tactfully enough, and I don't blame him. You know, it was like, what the hell do you know? You're the new guy. I had only been there for 2 weeks. I wasn't even in the bar yet. And I said, can I look into this? And, you know, what the hell? What's to look into? And he says, sure. And he holds it up like I'm a dog and I have to come over and fetch this file, right? And I certainly don't blame him. I mean, I had no idea what I was going to do. So I go through a whole series of research and sort of wild guesses that felt wild, and a lot of luck, it seems like, although, of course, throughout the book, there is a question, what is luck? And, you know, is there really luck that's pure by chance, or do we make things happen? I can't claim to offer a definitive answer of any of that, but a series of events happen, and I can explain them if you want. I wind up at one point calling down to Georgia and seeing if I can get them to drop the case.
Well, the critical thing is you got to conclude there are a rare number of cases in which one state refuses to extradite a prisoner, and so
right.
You want to see if you can make that happen. And the fascinating
right.
thing at the moment I want to take you to is you end up on the phone with Lester Maddox,
yes.
the legendary governor of Georgia. And tell us about that. Or maybe
you want me to read it?
Yeah, you got a little section. I want you to read about that,
okay.
Recounting that conversation.
I had, one of my strategies was, why not ask the governor of Georgia to withdraw the request? That would be one way of winning. And I said, I should be able to speak to Lester Maddox. Now, he was known as Axe Handle Maddox because he had a fried chicken restaurant, and he stood in the doorway with an axe handle threatening to hit with the axe handle any black person who attempted to enter his restaurant. This catapulted him to the governorship. This was like well known and well thought of enough to make him governor. So I'm thinking, well, I'm going to get this raving racist sort of guy. And I wangled away. It's a complicated story. And I wind up getting them to put him on the phone. And he first read some stuff. I had a probation officer investigate Giles as if he was coming up for sentencing to show he was rehabilitated. So then all of a sudden I get this call, and one of his assistants calls me. Mr. Carey's Governor Maddox will talk to you, and he read some of the materials you sent. Hold a minute. I'll get his secretary to see if he's ready or got into something else. More than a minute passed. I thought I might be dreaming. Is this Mr. Carey? A woman's voice said. Yes. I had given up on the pronunciation. Earlier I described how no one pronounces my name properly. Hold for the governor. Another minute, maybe two. I felt myself sweating. This is Governor Lester Maddox calling from Atlanta. His southern drawl was extreme, his voice friendly. Hello, Governor Maddox. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me. Yes, young man, well, I read what you sent, but I'm afraid I can't do anything for you. Do you have any doubt he's rehabilitated, Governor? Nah, I've seen that probation report. It's been a long time. I suppose he's as rehabilitated as the rest of us. Then why waste Georgia's money keeping him in jail? I'm going to be honest with you some. Every Christmas, I free some Negras, that's his word, N-I-G-R-A-S, from prison in the spirit of the holiday. My people collect the files and the best still in prison, and I pardon some of them, sometimes as many as a dozen, but this ain't Christmas. And, Governor, shouldn't we strive to keep that Christmas spirit alive the whole year through? That's my argument. Well, that's creative, young man, but I got a hell of a fight on my hands in the legislature. The assembly won't pass anything I send up. These bastards would love to stick me with a soft on Negra's story. Nobody can remember a governor down here pardoning someone who's still a fugitive. Have him come back to Georgia voluntarily in a year or two. Maybe I'll be able to do it. I appreciate that, Governor. Can I tell the governor of Pennsylvania that you don't mind if he doesn't send the guy back? Well, I don't know. You're playing me every which way now. Nah, it could get down here. It could get out. Now you come down here and visit his son. You're doing a fine job. Thanks, Governor. Good luck with the assembly. I hung up and sat back, not sure what had just happened. I liked his style and sense of humor. At the end, I wished Maddox good luck with the legislature, although I had no idea what the issues were between them. He might be pushing things I deeply opposed. And my Christmas every day of the year argument was naive and felt embarrassing. I was trying to absorb what had happened, but all I could think about was the absurdity of it all. He won't do it because it's not Christmas.
Right. So, but in the end, you end up talking to Arlen Specter, who was then the district attorney, right?
It turned out Specter was back. The only union in the city of Philadelphia, which is a huge, big Democratic union town, that backed Specter was Giles's construction union.
And in the end, I mean, somehow through all of this, you get the governor of Pennsylvania, then Milton Schaap, to refuse to extradite.
Yeah.
And
First time it had been done in Pennsylvania.
And this man gets his life back, all from some punk 28-year-old lawyer who didn't know enough not to get involved.
Too stupid to think there was nothing you could do.
Must have taught you something.
Well, it did and it didn't. You know, I think I had some of the feeling of, you know, what it might be to be a child actor. I thought, well, maybe I really got lucky and this is the best I'm ever going to do. And I didn't have a great theory about how I went along. I mean, I kind of systematically did a lot of things I can see now, but I didn't have a theory or an approach. And so in some ways it was a little scary, like, am I going to be able to match this again? But of course the main emotion was just amazement that I did this.
So this man, James Giles, got to go back and rejoin his family and resume his life.
Yeah. Lived the rest of his life, died of natural causes in Philadelphia.
We're speaking with David Carries. He is a veteran Philadelphia civil rights lawyer, and he's recounted some of his most interesting cases and experiences in a new book. It's called Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. Have some lines open if you want to give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Laura has been sending by from University City. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good morning. Good.
Good morning. Hi, this has been excellent. I really appreciate your insights and experience. I'm curious, I'm a law student at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm wondering what you see as the largest challenge for the next generation going into civil rights work.
Well, in many ways, a lot of the victories that I had and my generation had have been either reversed or at least retrenched. I mean, we've had 30 years of a very conservative dominance in the Supreme Court as well as in politics and culture. And for instance, right now, one of the big things I did after that case that we just talked about, the extradition case, I took on the bail system, and we were able to find in two years, 2,000 inmates who were actually there on very low bail, and although they posed no threat to anybody, just didn't have the money. We got them out with a project that I started. But there's actually now more people in jail pretrial than there were back then. And most of them are not there for violent crimes. It's the series of wars on drugs and wars on crime. So in many ways, things have gone back quite a lot. And that means there's an awful lot to do, including some of the same things that we once did.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Laura. You know, that you mentioned the bail fight, and that is an interesting story because you were young here, too. And maybe you could just describe the scene when you went down. You were sent by the defender's office to these hearings. This was in the Roundhouse, the police building, which Philadelphians know because it's
down at 8th and Race.
Right, 8th and Race, very near our studios here. You go down and there's this room. What do you see? Yeah.
Well, it was the strange scene. There were a series of desks in front of a little bench, like that where the judge was, a little bit raised up. And the judges in those days were magistrates. Some of them were lawyers, some of them weren't. And they were mostly political appointees. And I had no idea what to do. You know, this was the first place they sent you. I still am not even in the bar yet because there wasn't a right to a lawyer at the bail hearing, so they could send me down to this.
So that's why you went, because you didn't need a lawyer and you weren't yet.
I wasn't a lawyer. So the judge welcomes me, and I introduce myself. I said, I'm a new public defender. Judge welcomes me and hands me a card with a sort of get out of jail free, like a Monopoly card. I go back to my desk. They just say, sit over there, and I turn it over, and it's an ad for a bondsman. So the judge was handing out an ad for a bondsman, and I'm thinking, what is going on here, right?
And that's because the bondsman was a buddy of his, and he steered business his way.
Or anybody who came in with that card, maybe the judge got a cut. I don't know. I don't know. But for a judge to be recommending a particular bondsman is highly improper.
Pretty informal.
Yes. So they said, sit over there. And so I sit over there, and then they start calling cases, and there five people are brought up at once and put in a little plexiglass box, really, within the small courtroom. And they bring the first one up, and all that happens is papers start flying all around, copies of papers, criminal record, the charge, the complaint. And, you know, some of them land in front of me, but I have not talked to these people at all, to the clients. And so I say, you know, I'd like to talk to them before we have the interview. You don't need to talk to them. You know, we're all buddies here, right? They'll just say whatever they have to say. Don't worry about that. Well, you know, I had been taught and thought that you talk to a client and you present the best case for them. That's what you do. So they expected me just to sit there. So what I found is every step of the criminal justice system, I'm finding 20 things that I think are wrong. And you can't challenge everything, and you have to figure out how to be effective. And so I started maneuvering that, but this one was the first one, and I did it just by seeing the judge, not by saying there's a violation of the right to counsel, polarizing it. I figured, I'll just go see the judge. And he said, look, okay. Eventually we worked out a procedure where I would go in the plexiglass box for 15 minutes before the hearing start, and I talked to everybody. Then when they'd come out, I'd know something about him, and the judge wound up liking it, you know, because I had information for him.
So before this, whoever was down there as their representative, not necessarily a lawyer, would not have the most basic information. If they had an explanation or a defense or an extenuating circumstance, they wouldn't even know that because there was no provision to even have a conversation.
That's right. And the defendant might say something that was highly incriminating or might get their bail raised.
All right. David Carries is with us. He's a veteran civil rights lawyer. He has a new memoir called Philadelphia Freedom. We'll be back to talk to him in just a moment.
Marion Wright Edelman says our government has its priorities wrong when it comes to kids.
Can't afford $70 billion for children over 5 years, which you could afford in a few weeks. $700 billion to bail out Wall Street. We've got to build a citizens movement to say these priorities are wrong.
She founded a tough advocacy group called the Children's Defense Fund, and now she's got a new book about her life and work. I'm Farai Chidea, a champion for kids, next time on News and Notes.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
She said something terrible has happened.
Sister Mary Catherine Perko cannot erase her memories of 12 years ago. A parishioner attacked her fellow sisters at their home in Waterville, Maine. One of them died. Would they ever forgive the attacker?
We went to see his family. What could we do? It was so horrible.
Lessons of trust and forgiveness put to the test next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
When I was a kid, the bully was a big kid who gave me a wedgie and took my lunch money. But now there's a new kind of bullying, cyberbullying. Kids are using the internet to threaten and humiliate their peers, and the results can be devastating. 85% of middle school kids have reported they've been cyberbullied. I'm Dan Gottlieb. And on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about what it is and how to deal with it. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moscoane. We're speaking with David Carries. He is a well-known Philadelphia civil rights attorney, and he has a new memoir called Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. And we'll be taking your calls in a few minutes if you want them, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dave Carries, you were talking about when you were a young public defender just in Philadelphia, and I thought one thing before we leave this little episode of your life, you were talking about how there would seem to be chaotic arrangements in terms of who got bail and who didn't get bail among criminal defendants. And one of the things you discovered was that there was a special privilege offered to people who had private lawyers only.
Yeah, this was a shock to me. Well, I started looking into the bail system and noticing that a lot of people were sitting up there for 3 or 4 months prior to trial, even though they had low bail, which meant the judge had decided they weren't a risk to anybody or to run away. So it was just a lack of money. Yeah. Similarly, on the other hand, the people with high bail could get out if they were wealthy or had access to money, even if they were dangerous. So I combed the rules to see what ways that could be challenged. And I found a rule called Star 995. And the rule provided an informal procedure getting a bail hearing. And so I used the procedure. It said you send a letter to the DA, and I just went up and interviewed a bunch of people, and I used them as kind of a test, and I said, here's your notice to the DA's office under Star 995. It said you could get a hearing in 2 days in the miscellaneous court and argue that the bail's too high. That's what I wanted to do. Well, the DA's office reaction was, no, you can't use that. That's for the private lawyers. And what they said was that they had set up that procedure in an arrangement with the private lawyers to give them a chance for their defendants to come in 2 days. And I said, well, you know, fine, that's how it came about, but you can't have a rule on the books that poor people can't use, but people who are wealthy enough to hire a private lawyer can use. And they said, why not? So I was told to, if I had that complaint, raise it with the boss, Dick Sprague. Dick Sprague was the functional runner of the DA's office, and he wasn't the top DA. So I called Dick Sprague, and he just was very curt, hardly responded to me, just said, well, what would be wrong with that? You know, what's the problem? I did everything I could to explain it. I, as I recount in the book, I had this feeling that I was using so many words that it just felt weak. And yet, he was so clearly wrong. But he was in a position of power, and he could just say, well, too bad, right? Very few words.
Right, because they weren't entitled to a bail hearing anyway. So
that's right. They don't have to have any procedure. And I said, yeah, but if you offer a procedure, you got to offer it to everybody. You can't have a procedure on the book that's only for rich people. So that was my first challenge. And that one I brought in court. And there's an interesting, I think, funny, because I felt somewhat confused, didn't even know a lot about what was going on, but I won, and I wasn't even sure I won, the way the courtroom dynamics, and the judge had to remind me, you know, you won this.
Right. But essentially, I mean, what's remarkable about it is you had a situation here where there was just, it seems glaringly obvious that you have to at least offer the same things, and they didn't. And nobody had noticed it until some punk lawyer like you just pushed it and wouldn't give up on it.
I asked at the PD at the public defender, and they said, yeah, that's for private lawyers.
Yeah, that's what they do, right? We don't get that.
You know, people can get used to, even people who do very good things and are very good lawyers, like in other professions, can get used to things.
We have until the end of the hour, and I can't have you in without talking a bit about the story of the Camden 28. And this was a story of a break-in at the Camden, New Jersey draft office. 28 people, many of them Catholic priests and peace activists. a lot of fascinating things about this story. How is this different from a typical draft board break, which we've seen a lot of?
Well, first of all, there were over 350 break-ins of draft boards. So this was a big thing nationally. I think people don't realize how predominant or prevalent this became. And usually what they would do is, you know, it'd be a small suburban or rural draft board. They'd go in the bathroom right near closing time. Then after the workers closed, they'd come out of the bathroom and tear up all the files as a protest. Sometimes they even suspended themselves in hammocks up above a drop ceiling. That was the most sophisticated. But the Camden draft board was on the fifth floor of the post office and federal court building, a major big stone structure, five stories high, in the middle of an urban area. And
so this was a major burglary.
This was a burglary, and what you needed was burglary skills. Well, they tried, and you know they had a plan here or there. Then they almost gave up. They thought they were discovered. Then all of a sudden, a guy comes into the group named Bob Hardy. And Bob was a construction guy, a sort of handyman, and he knew how to do things. And so he, for instance, the first day he went to the scene, he noticed that there was an electronic alarm on the fire escape that they were going to use to go up to the fifth floor. If you, the first step you took on that fire escape, it would have set off an alarm and the police would have been there. So he came up with plans, and he started providing all the tools, all the plans, even bags of groceries.
Right. So just to recap, we're talking about a band of a couple of dozen peace activists, and then this new guy shows up who really knows what he's doing.
Yes.
Is enthusiastic.
He's a personal friend of a Catholic brother named Mike Giocondo, who was in it, and also a Father Michael Doyle, who's just an extraordinary person who's just tireless to this day in Camden in standing up for the poor people of really one of our most desperate cities, I think it's fair to say, in the United States. And Father Doyle had converted Hardy to Catholicism. So he has turned, what he does is actually the next day after he gets into the thing, he went into the FBI. And he told them, you know, this is happening, and he's against the war. Bob Hardy, he's against the war, but he thinks this is wrong. It's against the law. And they just say, well, stay with the group. And then it keeps going and going, and they tell him, you know, yeah, well, if they need something, get it for them.
So what we have is a situation where this group of peace activists, this guy Bob Hardy, known to one of the priests, comes in. He's actually working for the FBI.
Right.
Recording conversations?
So once in a while, mostly every morning, like 5 or 6 in the morning, he'd meet at a diner with his FBI contact, and he'd just spill out everything that had happened and tell them what was going
on. So the FBI is supplying the tools, like, you know, ropes and portable drills.
Now, portable drills are they're easy to get now, but back then that was a very unusual item, and it was crucial to the plan for reasons that it probably isn't worth explaining, but they really needed it. The actual drill they got when they couldn't find them in the stores was from the personal shop of an FBI agent. So this agent went home to a shop, got the drill, brought it to the FBI contact guy who gave it to Hardy, who gave it to the defendant. So the FBI wanted this to happen. But Hardy was told that...
The FBI informant and provocateur.
Hardy, yeah. Yes. He was told by the FBI people he dealt with that they would never let it happen. They would arrest them, and it would be a slap on the wrist, and they would stop it. But they didn't stop it. See, they sat around the day of the raid, over 100 of FBI agents all in hiding, and waited until the defendants tore up every piece of paper they could find and threw them out into the ground from the fire escape, in bags.
Totally wrecked the draft record.
Wrecked the draft board. As I said in the closing argument, neither side cared about those pieces of paper. See, to the government, they were part of the mechanism of war, but they were expendable because they wanted to set up these people.
So the FBI swoops in, arrests 28, or I guess they weren't there.
No, they weren't all there. There were some
conspirators elsewhere. And so you have this group of people on trial for serious federal charges.
Right.
And you get involved. And the critical a critical moment here was Bob Hardy, the FBI connection and informant, having a change of heart. What happened?
Well, I think the first thing, and this really, many things in the book strike me as almost, it's like a novel, but this one surely. Hardy, a couple of weeks after the action, everybody knows what he did. He's being interviewed by Sandy Grady, a reporter for the old Philadelphia Evening Bulletin. And Grady calls in the morning and says, "Can I come over today?" Hardy says, "Yeah." He had planned to go out with his son to do some errands. So Grady comes over and interviews Hardy. Hardy tells his son, "Go outside and play for an hour and then we'll go." The son climbed a tree, fell out of the tree, and was impaled on a metal fence and died a few days later. Now, this is just a horrible thing. And Hardy turned to Father Doyle. He said, "Would you do the service?"
Which, Father Doyle, who he was about to testify against in this case.
And he had just turned in and was now charged with 7 felonies totaling 47 years, which J. Edgar Hoover and John Mitchell announced to the world. They intended him to serve every year that, every day. So Doyle, of course, does the service. That's his job.
The funeral service for the son of the FBI informant who was about to testify against
him. And who had turned him in.
Who had turned him in.
And Doyle and I had already become close, and we were kind of talking a lot. And so, you know, I said, let's now try to see really what Bob feels about this. He did ask you to do the service. Talk to him. Don't be too aggressive about it, but talk to him. He'll come into your church. And they start talking, and Bob expressed that he doesn't feel so good about what he did, and that the FBI misrepresented and really turned on him. So he was angry as well. And so anyway, we maneuver it for many, many weeks, months. We wanted to go very slowly. Finally, we get to the point where Hardy says he'll meet with me. And Michael Doyle had told him that I had a way that we could make it right. And so we start meeting in South Jersey, driving around for, you know, an hour. I did to make sure I wasn't followed. I thought if they caught us, they would probably have him committed or he might have some strange accident. It's happened before, you know. So, and at the very least, they would try to destroy his credibility and make him a useless witness. So we get to the point where he's saying he made it happen. And, I mean, there's all the proof to back it up. It's very strong. And I said, look, let's preserve this. You can't tell. Life is short. And you don't know what happens. Let's preserve this in an affidavit.
So you have the government's chief witness in the trial against your defendants, and you now have them to the point where I want you to tell the whole story to me in an affidavit. The government and the FBI have no idea any of these conversations are happening.
No idea, or they would go nuts. And so I take from the interviews, at first I didn't, the first time I met him, I didn't even bring a piece of paper. I didn't want to freak him out. So we just chatted. Then he let me take notes. I said, "Bob, you know, do you mind next time I'll bring a pad?" So anyway, I put this affidavit together, almost all from words he had said to me at various times in these other things, including that when the raid actually happened, that his contact FBI agent said that it was ordered to happen by someone at the Western White House. Now, that's Nixon's headquarters in San Clemente, California. We get the affidavit down, and then I wanted to get it filed because this is the way really informants go like this. You know, he could go back to them very easily. So so I said, "Bob, do you mind if I file it as part of a pretrial motion, which I could make it seem somewhat reasonable to be attached to a motion? Once it's on file, you're safe.
He's committed.
The testimony is safe. Your friends won't go to jail for 47 years. He said, "Okay." So I filed it, and the next day it was front page on the New York Times and changed the whole tenor of the case.
And the lovely little detail about this is you to have him sign the affidavit, meeting him at midnight under the Walt Whitman Bridge,
yes.
After having driven around to be sure you're not followed. We're almost out of time, but we should say just a little bit about the I mean, you had this 28 defendants, some of whom wanted to go to jail to make a statement, others who didn't want to go to jail. And there was this interesting defense, one of two, jury nullification.
Yes.
Without bearing us in legal technicalities, what was that? How did it come to play a role in the trial?
Okay. Jury nullification is basically talks about the power of a jury to find somebody not guilty, even though they might have violated a law, either because the law is oppressive or the application of it is oppressive. An example was that we used in the trials, the Boston Tea Party. It's illegal to destroy tea or throw it in a bay, and no one quarrels with that. But these people, of course, were doing it to stand up for their nation, and the juries didn't want to indict them or to convict them. So they would nullify that application of that law. Well, the anti-war movement had long struggled to get this, and using self-representation, which we did here, the defendants spoke for themselves as well as lawyers speaking, to humanize it all. And so basically you're asking the jury to say, yes, we generally don't like burglaries into the federal building, but this one was justified and you should acquit them.
And you managed to get this judge, who was not particularly sympathetic, to give that jury instruction, right?
Yeah. He gave an instruction that Moore had to do. He first of all let us put in a lot of evidence about nullification. Then he gave an instruction about a defense that unfortunately has never been used since. This is the only application of it, where they were allowed to use a defense based on what Hardy had done, even though it technically wasn't entrapment.
It's a fascinating story. We encourage you to read it. The name of the book is Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. Dave Carey, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Susan Greenbaum and Devorah Lissick and Patty Lesming are producers of Radio Times. Our engineers today were Scott Williams and Al Banks. For Marty Moscoe, and I'm Dave Davies. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported NPR station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.